Good evening. Welcome to this exploration of the Bodhisattva precepts. I hope that this will be an enlivening and good learning and exploring experience to together look at the way that these 10 Bodhisattva precepts play out in our lives and get into all the questions and details that can come up around these precepts as they're lived. And we have 6 weeks, so I thought that there's 10 precepts that we'll look at, and we have the 5 weeks, we could do maybe like 2 precepts each. And today, as the beginning of the series, we can actually, I thought, maybe not get into the actual, you know, list of precepts themselves, but like talk about the background of how these particular precepts came to be our Zen lineage precepts, and where that came from, and the meaning behind it. That's kind of an overview. Yeah, so this, I think, first in the series might be a little different than the rest. I thought maybe we won't get into all the ways that they actually play out. We'll see what we have time for. But I think the story of how these precepts came to be our Zen precepts to me is like very interesting, and you might not all know this story. So.
Once upon a time,
in the ancient land of India, lived Shakyamuni Buddha. And this first collection of teachings of the Buddha, we call the Pali Canon, right? The foundational early teachings of the Buddha before the Mahayana, this new kind of vaster, flowering, and creative expression of Buddha's teaching emerged. We have these basic, very practical and instructive teachings of the Pali Canon, from the Pali language, and many sutras, but also we understand that the Buddha at some point started teaching these ethical precepts. Some stories say that it wasn't at the beginning of the Buddha's teaching career. Especially the precepts for the monks, which I think maybe came first. He was first talking to these yogis living in the forest, and one story goes that they were, you know, the people that came to practice in the forest with the Buddhas were already like renunciates. They were living very simple. They were already committed to compassion and taking care of each other and harmlessness. It was kind of the norm for yogis in Buddha's time. I think they're, without a written code of precepts, it was just a natural way of living, right? To devote their lives to spiritual practice. So the implication was that they didn't need any particular precepts. But then as the Sangha of practitioners started to grow, as all things start to grow and become more and more established and more people involved, then difficulties started arising. So the Buddha would come up with this kind of code of conduct, one precept at a time. He never kind of said, okay, here's the list of 10 come from above, or something like this. It was more like there'd be some particular problem in the Sangha, and the Buddha would say, well, okay, I guess let's set up a guideline for this, because it seems to be causing disharmony. Kind of like that. And often in the sangha of the monks living in the forest, often the impetus to set up a new precept would come from the lay community, interestingly, that were like had a certain standard of what they thought the renunciate yogis should be practicing like. Over and over again we see this in the Vinaya texts, that the the lay supporters would come to the Buddha and say, we don't really like how your monks are doing such and such. And the Buddha would be like, oh, okay, thanks for letting me know. And then he would go to the monks and say, actually, can you guys cool it on this or that? So he was almost just responding to different requests. And so it was a kind of socialization process, maybe, of the Buddhist Sangha. And then early on, too, people, lay people as well as monks, started taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And maybe in the early days of taking refuge, becoming a disciple of Buddha, as either a lay follower or a monastic follower, it was just the three refuges. Then at some point, maybe the monks had these guidelines and they felt, the Buddha felt and others felt that, well, lay people should have these guidelines too. So I don't know exactly when in the Buddha's life that came into being, but these five precepts were early on and became this kind of standard for everybody, the lay people as well as the monks. And then the monks had more also. And those lay precepts are very similar to the first five of our bodhisattva precepts. Not killing life, not taking what's not given, not misusing sexuality, not speaking falsely, not, originally it said drinking alcohol, and then we include that to be intoxicants. And so those five became this kind of like, maybe kind of a serious commitment for the lay followers of the Buddha. And at the same time, in the Pali Canon, the Buddha taught many times this list of 10 wholesome actions and 10 unwholesome actions. And this is also very similar to our precepts, but not exactly the same. In this case, they were not precepts. They were just like just recommended karmic activity. And if you wanted to look, I didn't print this out for everybody, although I considered it, but maybe you don't want lots of reading. If you want, we could make this copies of this. But there's in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings, you might have seen this book of the Buddha Sutras. In the sutra number 41, there's the Salayaka Sutta, and the Buddha says, how are there three kinds of bodily conduct not in accordance with the Dharma? And these three bodily actions of body are not killing, not taking what's not given, not misusing sexuality. Right? So it's these same three. And then there's, how are there four kinds of verbal conduct not in accord with the Dharma? And so four speech conducts. These are, again, not precepts. These were never like ceremonially given and received. They're just ways of acting in the world. These four verbal ones are speaking falsely, lying, speaking divisively, and I think really pretty much the same as not speaking of others' faults or slander, that precept, and then not speaking harshly, which is just like kind of aggressively and harshly, which is a little different from any of ours, but maybe it's, we could try to relate it to not praising self and belittling others. And then a fourth one of just, the Buddha calls idle chatter, or just like random, useless gossip. It's not exactly like, you know, explicitly harmful, but more like just kind of a waste of time and a distraction. So that one's a little bit like kind of stricter sort of standard. Almost like don't speak at all unless it's like really beneficial. So there's four, and that one we don't have in our bodhisattva precepts. If we go through the kind of the list of our 10 and try to correlate them with these 10 wholesome actions or unwholesome actions, they're a little bit different in that, with that one. And then the Buddha says, how are the three kinds of mental conduct not in accord with the Dharma. So we have body, speech, and mind, conduct. So you got these three bodily ones, physical ones, three speech, three mental ones are similar to our precepts, not being possessive or covetous, not being angry or indulging in anger or holding ill will. Those two are the same pretty much as our bodhisattva precepts. And the third is not holding false views. So that sounds quite different from not disparaging the three treasures, which is our last one. But we might say that that would be an interpretation. Not holding views that go against the true Dharma would be like disparaging Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So they're related, but a different wording. Yes?
This might be slightly tangential, kind of a historical question, but in the way that Jesus and his followers were Jews, were the followers of Buddha, were they Hindus?
In a way, as I understand it, the word Hinduism is coined by the British at some point a couple hundred years ago to account for this like wide variety of Indian religions that are similar, but there's a lot of variety. It's so complex still in modern times, the Indian spiritual situation. And I think it is a convenient way to talk about this collection of yoga traditions and Shaivism, it's, you know, worshippers of Shiva, and Vaishnavism, worshippers of Vishnu, and all these in India they would consider these like different schools, but they all get lumped under what we call Hinduism. And the Buddha's time, I think it was quite similar. I don't know exactly if there were the Shaivites and the Vaishnavites, but there were Jains. We still have Jainism in the Buddha's sutras. We hear about the founder of Jainism lived at the same time as the Buddha. So like Brahmanism, we might say, in the time of Buddha, and the followers of the Vedas, these really ancient texts, and the caste system with Vedic priests, all that was going on at the time of Buddha, as well as these. So the Vedas were like the Brahmin priests, and then there were these Shramanas that I was just this weekend at this conference where Robert Thurman was there, and he was talking a little bit about this history, and he translated the Shramanas as the dropouts. the Indian dropouts. So they dropped out of this whole structure of institutional religion, and they were just kind of like wandering yogis. And so it was complex spiritual scene in Buddha's India, and I think most people who did come to follow the Buddha were followers of some other spiritual practice beforehand. Some maybe just weren't, but they were usually part of one thing or another and sort of switched over. Yeah, yeah. And I think that those other schools also had codes of conduct. And I don't know if any were before the Buddha. I know that like Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, which is now a popular form of yoga in the West, the Ashtanga Yoga is from Patanjali, and they have a code of conduct that has five precepts that are almost identical to these five, but that came after Buddha, actually. Patanjali lived, I can't remember when, but some centuries after Buddha. So it probably came from Buddhism.
And this one, hopefully, is simpler. Is Sanskrit the written form of Pali? Was Pali written in the Sanskrit alphabet? Is Sanskrit an alphabet or a language?
Both Pali and Sanskrit have a written version and a spoken version. And but as I understand it, Sanskrit was like the kind of holy language of India. Even in Buddha's time, it was a little bit maybe like Latin for the church, and it was used for like mantras and sutras, and I don't think, as I recall, and I'm not sure, quite sure, can't quite remember, but I think it's Sanskrit was never spoken as just a colloquial language. It was more like a holy language, like the language of the gods, and that Pali was more like a local dialect. And it's very close. The sound is almost identical in many cases. But Pali was like a spoken dialect that the Buddha's area of India spoke. So part of... What's that?
The Buddha spoke Pali.
Or something like that. I think roughly like this. I think the story is more complex when you go into it. But I think the nice thing about this, the story as I understand it, is that the Buddha didn't want to use this kind of like high religious language. He wanted to use the local language that everyone could understand and kind of like bring it down to earth. So the Pali Canon is in this kind of more local language. And then the Mahayana Sutras were all written in Sanskrit. And it's maybe because they came later and the Pali language had died out. Or maybe it was maybe to be more in accord with the Vedas and these, all these so-called Hindu schools that were all their texts were in Sanskrit. So I'm not sure why it changed, but that is part of this, why we call it the Pali Canon, this particular group of early teachings in that language.
Question with the Mahayana and Sutras, were those then verbally transmitted like some of the Christian texts for two or three generations and then finally written down in Sanskrit?
I think probably so. Definitely the Pali ones were oral transmission before they got written down, and probably with the Sanskrit. And then at some point, as the tradition maybe got more and more established and more people became literate, then they became written right from the start.
Yes. But written from an oral source.
Yeah, although, you know, we say all the sutras were Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings, but of course the historians will say these other sutras came later, that went from the historical Buddha. But I think from a kind of faith perspective, we could say they're all the teachings of the awakened one, the Buddha, but the awakened one maybe can take these different forms of anonymous, incarnations that can write this stuff and circulate it. Yeah, so we have these kind of ethical guidelines of how to live in the world, conduct of body, speech, and mind from early on. And just to note, while we're on that list of the 10 wholesome and unwholesome actions, this, you know, Sutta 41 has it, but many times the Buddha taught this list as just how to live in the world, as opposed to like a ceremonial vow or something. And that list is, again, is almost the same as ours. You could say the main differences are, instead of not holding false views, ours precepts say not disparaging the three treasures. And the instead of like idle chatter and gossip, we have the not intoxicating, we say, self or others. Which the 10 wholesome and unwholesome actions doesn't have anything about intoxicants in there. Because in a way, you could say, the Buddha would sometimes talk about this and say, it's not exactly an ethical precept in itself. It's more that it's this condition that's where, with intoxicants, people then tend to break all the other precepts, where they tend to get careless and heedless around their other conduct. So in itself, it's not really so much an ethical thing, but it's linked to all these ethical issues. And we'll get into that when we get into this fifth precept. But I think what happened with our list, which we'll see how that comes from a Mahayana Sutra, is it's a kind of combination, in a way, of these five precepts. They wanted to put in something about intoxicants, because it's such an important precept of the five precepts. But they also wanted to include this whole list of body, speech, and mind precepts. So they like substitute in the intoxicants from the list of five for the idle chatter, which is maybe the least harmful, maybe, of the... from that list of 10. And maybe we could even say there's some relationship of, like, I've never heard this put, but of something about intoxicants and like this kind of wasting time and sort of distraction, right, are somewhat related.
Texting.
Yeah, and it's kind of, yeah, you know, or idle gossip is kind of intoxicating and distracting, and maybe again it can lead into going against these other precepts. So that's the Pali, that's the pre-Mahayana teachings. And then comes the Mahayana, the great vehicle, and all these new sutras like the Prajnaparamita sutras, the flower ornament sutra, the lotus sutra, start emerging, colorful, and they've really, you know, if you read the early sutras and the Mahayana sutras, you can tell almost always which is which as far as the style. The Pali is a nice, very practical manual, step-by-step instructions, and the Mahayana is this blooming, like, you know, magical display of flowers and lights and many, many, many Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. What's that?
10,000
million, and vast time scale and vast space scale and multiple universes. And of course the teachings are woven in here, but I think it's just meant to like open our mind. And so one of the Mahayana sutras is this one that I handed out, the Brahma Jala Sutra, the Brahma Net Sutra, which is the source of our particular list of these 10 precepts are directly quoted from this sutra. And, it's this beautiful sutra.
So it's the source text of the precepts.
It's the source text of our, but you know, we say in our Soto Zen tradition, we call it 16 Bodhisattva precepts. And the 16 are the three refuges, which are, of course, part of the earliest tradition. In fact, one of the sutras here that I found has the three refuges and these five lay precepts all in one sutra as kind of eight, and it's called eight great practices or gifts. So that's a way. So in that early sutra, they link the refuges with those five precepts. So this may be the precedent for Dogen. I think was the one who maybe first called it 16 precepts. The three refuges, the three pure precepts, which we had a class series a few years ago on these three pure precepts, which are embracing and sustaining right conduct, all good and living beings. And that comes from some other sutras, and particularly this Asanga's treatise on the Bodhisattva precepts in the Bodhisattva Bhumi. That's another story. This class, we're not even going to look at the refuges and these three pure precepts. And then these 10 come from this Brahma Jala Sutra. So there's like, in a way, three different sources. Dogen, you know, with some past precedent, pulls them together into this list of 16. So, so this sutra just talks about the 10. Yeah, the sutra doesn't mention the refuges or the three pure precepts. There's one other Mahayana sutra that just recently got translated into English that often gets quoted alongside this Brahma Jala Sutra, called the Bodhisattva's Jewel Necklace of Primary Actions Sutra. And this has the same list of these 10 as the Brahma Jala Sutra. And I think they probably both emerged around the same time. But this one also includes three pure precepts. So, you know, it could be from a kind of like historical and developmental study. We could spend weeks just talking about this whole, how these stories evolved, and I think it's fascinating, but this is just the kind of brief version. Now, also part of this Brahma Jala Sutra is that scholars nowadays pretty much all agree that it's a so-called apocryphal sutra, and apocryphal means it was written in China. In a way, like a lot of the Mahayana sutras are maybe not the historical Shakyamuni Buddha, but I think that the Buddhist definition of apocryphal nowadays means it was not Indian. It was not written in Sanskrit, and there's no Sanskrit version of it, even though the title is Brahmajala, which is a Sanskrit word. It says in our Chinese versions of it that we have that it was translated from the Sanskrit into Chinese by Kumarajiva, who's one of the great translators of Sanskrit into Chinese. Yeah, he was an Indian who came to China and was one of those, there were so many translators, but I think Kumarajiva and Xuanzang were maybe like the two greatest of all time, that like Kumarajiva was really into Prajnaparamita and Madhyamaka. He translated lots of Nagarjuna and huge quantities. He had this whole, at some point this was now Buddhism was starting to thrive in China and the emperor kind of hired him. I think one story is the emperor even like captured him and locked him in the palace and gave him this huge team of translators and say, translate this whole, you know, canon, which he did for years. And this sutra was supposedly translated in 406 of the Common Era. It's a long time ago.
So this is before Bodhidharma?
Yeah, before Bodhidharma. Mm-hmm. And before Zen, officially, yeah, so that would be Bodhidharma. Yeah. And but the Mahayana was newly coming to fruition in China at this point, due to the efforts of Kumarajiva and others, and that this is one of the many things. There's some other things that are huge volumes of Nagarjuna that are translated by Kumarajiva, but actually people say were probably actually written by Kumarajiva and then attributed to Nagarjuna. And so this could be the same. It could be that Kumarajiva wrote this, or it could be that there was some obscure Indian sutra that was then lost. But people, I think the modern scholars say, you can tell that it's Chinese by certain teachings in it. Like there's a lot of mention of filial piety in the sutra, and that was not really an issue for the Indians, but it was really important in China. Yeah, still. So, but at any rate, the Chinese and the Japanese just took it as an authentic Mahayana sutra, and to the point where it was became like a very important sutra. Another clue that it wasn't an Indian one is that the Tibetans have never heard of it. It didn't get translated into Tibetan. They have other Bodhisattva precepts, but not from this sutra. So that's part of the story.
And when was the Kumarajiva around?
This 406.
406.
So
before Common Era?
Common Era. So the fifth. So the 5th century. It was a long time ago, right? And for the flavor of the Mahayana and kind of Buddha nature teachings is woven into this, which is, I think, partly why it was so important to the Zen tradition. I think it's maybe why Zen later felt like this sutra is like one of our heart sutras. Also, this Brahmajala Sutra was supposed to have been like huge volumes of sutra, and most of it we don't have even in Chinese. But so when you read the parts that we do have, they're like kind of two volumes, and they kind of start in the. It feels like you're starting in the middle of some longer sutra when you read it, and it's not all the Bodhisattva precepts. There's other stuff in there too. But the main part that people picked up on were these Bodhisattva precepts. So here, the Buddha speaks the Brahmanet Sutra. This is just like the second volume, and 60 pages covers all the introduction, and then these 10 precepts, and then there's also 48 minor precepts, which is with commentary on them. And in China, they still emphasize that. But in Zen, in Soto Zen, they still sometimes do these longer, like a full moon ceremony where they go through all the minor precepts. So it's still acknowledged as part of the sutra, but it's not part of Dogen 16, so it's de-emphasized. So it's part of Soto Zen, but peripherally, the 48 minor ones. And so that's one translation. And there's this other book called Bodhisattva Precepts that's like, I think he might be American, this guy Rulu, who's in a Chinese monk tradition. And he's a translator. And all these sutras, Mahayana sutras on Bodhisattva precepts, hundreds of pages of them. So there's other ones too. And it's kind of neat. So it includes this Brahmajala Sutra. And he also translated the Jewel Necklace Sutra. So it's a little bit like there's no commentary. It's just sutras. And I don't know if I'd necessarily recommend it unless you're like really into that kind of stuff. But it's interesting to compare the different ones. And then, of course, Being Upright is our great classic from Tenzin Anderson Roshi on the Bodhisattva precepts.
So these two pages are part of the Brahmajala Sutra?
Yes, yeah, they're a part of, because it's like, you know...
Is it like in there like this, or is this kind of pulled together?
It's excerpts, yeah. So what I did to make this, you know, as you probably know, I love studying these sutras, and I thought, let's make like the definitive one piece of paper handout on the Brahmajala Sutra. So I looked at, there's like probably four different translations in English now, and this, so I looked at them all, and I pulled out lines that, because there's several lines in the sutra that we quote in our different ceremonies, precept ceremonies, so we're really linked to the sutra, and there's a lot more that comes before this, so this is kind of the preamble here, the before No Killing Life. Right? These several paragraphs are like the part leading up to the 10 precepts. Maybe I skipped a few little sections, but the part that most like struck me, I kind of put in here. And then the 10 with their commentaries. And again, I've seen versions of the Soto Zen ordination ceremonies, where in the ordination ceremony, they'll read the commentary of each precept. So, we're really coming from this sutra. This sutra, somehow it came out in China around the 5th century, and Kumarajiva had something to do with it. And then it became like the standard, and still in China, it's like the... Lay people can receive the 10 major and 48 minor Bodhisattva precepts, and pretty much all the monks in China, China, Korea, and Vietnam all have like Zen traditions, right? They all have this thing of, they become novice monks, they receive 10 novice precepts, which is another different list, and then they receive these Indian, you know, so-called Hinayana kind of monastic precepts, like hundreds of monastic precepts, which are a little different from monks and nuns, and they don't follow them all exactly in China, but ceremonially they do that. And then after that, now they're like an official monk, then they receive the Bodhisattva precepts as a kind of Mahayana compassionate practice. So these layers, Japan was the same format of monastic precepts that weren't so much about compassion for others. They were more about like personal conduct, right? Like things like not eating after noon. Like that doesn't harm anyone else, but it's like, it's just for training one's own attachments, right? And that's why they're called kind of like Hinayana. But the Mahayana Zen monks all receive those ones too, because that's the Buddhist tradition and everywhere except Japan. So in Japan, they had the same thing for many centuries of these layers of monastic and Bodhisattva precepts up to you maybe have heard this story, but if not, this is, I think, an important part of our tradition, because we're a funny little animal in the Buddhist world. Our Japanese Zen, all Japanese Buddhism is this unusual Buddhist country, because around the 7th century, I think, so this sutra had been around a couple hundred years. Saicho was this monk who, in Japan, went to China and brought and practiced in the Tiantai tradition and brought back that teaching of Tiantai Buddhism to Japan. And then he kind of started tweaking, you know, made it his own. And part of making it his own is he said, we are like totally Mahayana. This whole country of Japan, there are no such thing as like, there's no kind of Theravada kind of school, something like that in Japan. We're into the Mahayana, which means great compassion for all beings. It means we're not so into trying to purify ourself as the foremost thing, except just in order to benefit beings. So because we have this Mahayana compassionate bodhisattva spirit, and our sutras now, we emphasize the Mahayana sutras, and in our wisdom teachings are Mahayana, our meditation practices are Mahayana. Let's have our precepts practices be only Mahayana. So it was from this great compassionate spirit. He's like, we don't even really need that kind of Hinayana kind of stuff. It's like, it's a little too self-involved, maybe he felt.
This was at Dogen's?
This was Saicho, and so like maybe 500 years before Dogen, in like the 7th century, I think, 7th or 8th, 7th, I think, in Japan now, yeah. So Zen wasn't yet there. Dogen came in the 13th century. So Saicho even petitioned the government, the Japanese emperor. He wrote, and we have these treatises now, that he wrote these letters saying, I ask, and also the government-controlled ordinations. So there was some politics was involved here too. And Saicho was trying to set up his own new school. And he's like, I want to do my own bodhisattva precepts ordinations on Mount Hiei in Kyoto. And not have to register with the government and do this monastic precepts thing where you have to get permission from the government to be a monk and stuff, which I think still in China maybe somewhat connected to the government like this. And they said, no, that's ridiculous. We can't. Those are the Buddha's precepts for the last 1,000 years. You can't just like throw them out. But soon after Saicho died, again, a lot could be told about the historical conditions here, but somehow his disciples convinced the government to do this. And okay, you can do your own precepts thing on Mount Hiei with only bodhisattva precepts, only Mahayana. And you can do away with all those dusty old monastic precepts, which actually, many of them didn't even apply anymore. Things, for example, like eating after noon, they all had that precept, but nobody followed it. They do it like we do. We have like we call it medicine, right? So we don't do the meal chant in the evening for sesshins because of that old precept, but we still eat it. And that, I think that was the case even in Saito's time, depending on the people. Some, I think, were really strict about these things and some weren't. So that was this huge shift when the government agreed. And then, over the centuries, the entire country of Japan just gradually dropped away the old Hinayana monastic precepts. And everybody was ordained as monastics or lay people with the same bodhisattva precepts. Unprecedented. And there's no other Buddhist country, Mahayana or Theravada or anyone that does this. So we're this funny thing, and when you go to like inter-Buddhist conferences, which I've been to a bunch of these, they sometimes don't know what to make of us because we're not quite officially monastic without these precepts, but yet we're trying to live that way. Especially if there's people like, you know, living their whole life in a monastery or something, but they're not technically like bhikshus and bhikshunis, right? We don't have those precepts. So it's just good, I think, to know that our tradition is unusual in that way. And there's times when I personally have felt like we're really missing that. There's been times in my practice I made great efforts to try to receive those other precepts because I'm like, I think we're missing this piece. I put a lot of energy into it in the past, and it never worked out, actually, for me. Well, there's lots of more stories I could tell about that. Yeah, San Francisco Zen Center didn't like the idea, actually. Well, one of the big ones is that I think made for even greater shifts in the future is celibacy. Yeah. So even for both the novice precepts and the full ordination monastic precepts is this vow. And even if it's like the root precepts, it's like the main ones that are like, if you're not celibate, then you're like no longer a monk, basically. Buddha was really big on that one. And I think maybe, you know, this is a whole other story. Maybe when we get into our third precept, we can talk about it more. But I think of it now as maybe less about, like, sexuality itself and sexual energy, and more about the practical implications for his monastic sangha. That if in the monastery and living out in the forest, if the babies started to come on the scene, you have to take care of them. And that would like change the whole, then you have to build buildings. And you maybe can't rely on just begging anymore, right? You need more stability. So it may have been just purely practical thing. If we want to live this really simple way in the forest with not even any buildings, we gotta like, families will start to change the whole structure of the institution for the monks. Maybe it could be one story, but
Buddha would probably have a different reason. But would it be mentioned that he would have a reason for the celibacy?
He did talk about it too in terms of like desire, you know, getting like pulled around too much by desire. But I think there were some of these reasons about the practical thing too are in there in the sutras and the Vinaya texts. But it's a little bit ambiguous, the third precept in this, and we don't have the Sanskrit. And the Chinese character for the third precept could be translated as kind of like sexual greed, or it could be just translated as any sexual conduct. And so in English, some of the translators just say, no sex, but that's the same one that we have now, right? And some say, that's too strong. It's more like greed or lewdness. Yeah. And in the Chinese dictionaries, it has these multiple definitions. So, but at any rate, because at some point, much later than Saicho's time, right, just like a couple hundred years ago in Japan, because the priests, monks didn't have those monastic precepts from many centuries, they didn't have them. But it was kind of assumed that celibacy was how you live as an ordained person. But it wasn't written, it was just like a social custom. But then in the 1800s, it was more like due to political conditions again, the government changed, and it was more like, well now, the monks can get married and have kids if they want. And of course that happened, right, in a major way. So, but it couldn't really have happened if it wasn't for Saicho in the 7th century that threw out like those other precepts, like the celibacy precept. But for like 700 years, even without that precept, it was kind of understood that the priests didn't have families.
I think I heard that the reason they had marriage or like you could have kids and stuff was that you were less of a threat to the government. If you had kids, that way you'd be more
tested. It was the thought that it kind of weakened the power of the Buddhist institution. And in some ways, it changed it in huge ways.
There's, I was thinking more of the government, actually.
What's that?
I was thinking more of the government, actually, not the practice of Buddhism. That was the reason why this was okay to get married.
Actually, there's an interesting book that describes this whole process called Neither Monk Nor Layman by actually a San Francisco Zen Center author that goes through all, it's a very complicated scenario about this transition, but it's actually the government, again, the government had secular laws about priests being celibate. That sounds so strange to us. But that's how it was until the 1800s in Japan. And it's just that at this Meiji Reformation time, the government just lifted that ban. They never said the priests have to get married. They just said, we're not going to control we're going to separate church and state, basically. And strangely, the priests are like, oh, okay, then we'll just do that now. I mean, it's, again, more complex, but.
Is Japan the only country where priests can marry?
Yeah. Except for, well, we should say that Korea, because of the Japanese influence, after this change, Japanese went into Korea and kind of talked to the Korean Buddhist institution about this change, and most of them resisted it. But there is one order that's smaller, that is similar to the Japanese one, where it's like married priests in Korea, but most of them are not, and most of them have these Hinayana precepts. And in Tibet, it's not exactly monks, but it's like they're like priests, and they have families. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
And like carrying money.
Yeah, that's another one.
Theravadan precept.
Yeah.
Is not in the priests can't carry money.
Yeah. Right. And even then, this is an example of some of these minor precepts. I think the celibacy one, people feel like that was really like a pivotal, because it's a lifestyle change in a big way. But not carrying money, having traveled in Thailand, where those monks are much more literal with the precepts, most of them actually do use money in Thailand, except for these really strict forest monks, like, so we know, like, Adan Amaro in the Scoop in California. They're this very, like, small group of, like, the super literal ones. So you see monks in grocery stores in their robes in Thailand buying stuff in the cities, but there are some who keep it literally. And in China, again, they have that precept literally, but they don't follow it literally. So it's kind of nice to have precepts where you can actually, like, I'm behind this precept, I want to actually follow it, instead of like, well, it's just an ancient tradition, so we keep it, but it's just for the, we don't really practice with it. I think it's a lot of the Buddhist world is like that. Interesting. That's a good one that you just happened to open to there. Yeah, that's one of the minor precepts. Yeah, and you can see why, right? So then this Brahmajala Sutra becomes really big for the Tendai school in Japan, and Saicho and his followers found some text called the Bodhidharma One Mind Precepts, and this is again before. Let's see, how was this? This was now after Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma was around like 500, and Saicho was 600 or 700. So Bodhidharma was in China. But Zen had not yet come to Japan until 1200 with Dogen. But Saicho knew about this text called the Bodhidharma One Mind Precept. So it's interesting to me that they knew about Zen in China, about Chan, but it never came to flourish in Japan for many more centuries. Maybe it was too weird or something, or esoteric, although Tendai seems more esoteric to me. But at any rate, Bodhidharma was known to be the Zen founder, and these one mind precepts, as you can imagine, are like this kind of ultimate version of the precepts, like within the one mind of reality, the one all-inclusive awareness we all share, where we as individuals are more like just appearances of individuals. In these ultimate precepts, you can't really like kill a life, because birth and death themselves don't really come and go from this ultimate perspective. There's only boundless eternal life. We can't even call life. It's the unborn, right? So ultimately there's no birth and death. So if we realize that, that's the precept of so-called no killing. You realize that life cannot actually be killed ultimately. And then conventionally, we could say it can. But I think the beauty of these one mind precepts, and maybe we can get into it as we go through the actual conventional precepts, I think is, we definitely want to talk about that, but we can also investigate what would it mean, the ultimate meaning. My understanding is that if we realize the ultimate unborn, where there is no, nothing can be killed, right? If we truly realize that, not just the idea of it, we embody it and realize it, then we do not actually kill on the conventional level, because there's no reason to, right? It's like killing always comes from the belief in separation. Now we're talking about literal killing is like there's somebody that I want to get rid of, or it's like it's based on the literal killing is based on the delusion that we're separate beings. So if we realize the reality that we're really not separate, we're like unable to kill on the literal level. And just this weekend, one of my favorite, I was at this Science and Non-Duality conference. And one of my favorite teachers, Rupert Spira, a non-duality teacher, who I think is just very clear, really understands and lives this. But he doesn't talk much about the ethical part. And so I asked him after the talk, I'm like, if one really understands this, that everything is awareness and there's nothing outside of that and there's no separation therefore between anybody and anything, then is it possible to cause any harm, like in the moment of being in that view, is it possible to harm any other living being in any possible way? Like, give it to me straight. Like, I want to hear you say it. And he said, he said, almost impossible. And I regret that I didn't follow up to ask what kind of exceptions there might be. But he was really like, you know, that's correct. Like, it's basically impossible. And so you could say, at times, of course, we might be in that perspective, but we fall out of it. And we could say, if we want it, it's a kind of nice criterion. If we want to know if we're continuously in that perspective, which would be like being a Buddha, right? It means like incapable of causing any harm to anyone. And to my understanding, I think that really, that makes sense to me. And when I feel like I am harming and coming from that belief in separation, I know that I'm not in the view of reality. So these Bodhidharma one mind precepts are pointing out this new point, right? And each of the 10 has its own ultimate version that hopefully, you know, plays out in the conventional version. And it was a Zen thing. But the Tendai people picked up on it and said, our precepts are now Bodhidharma's one mind precepts. Before there was even Zen. In Japan, this is. And, those, of course, are quoted from the Brahmajala Sutra, but they're this new kind of ultimate version. And then, later, so they were kind of like a wisdom teaching about non-duality, actually. The Bodhisattva precepts took on this new meaning, and that meaning became more and more important, sometimes to the, you know, kind of starting to ignore the more conventional meaning of actually, let's try to practice not killing others, you know. Because it became so Mahayana. This is the problem, if you like, we're so inspired by the ultimate Mahayana view, which is all about compassion and non-separation, but we forget the kind of grounding and the actual, you know, how do we actually live in the world? It seemed like that actually happened in Japan. So over the centuries, this was, the Tendai school became more and more corrupt. They had more and more sublime, awesome, ultimate teachings, but the way they were starting to actually carry weapons and stuff like this. So it became too skewered to that side. And then Zen came on the scene, and I think Eisai, who was one of the first to, was one of Dogen's teachers actually, Rinzai Zen teacher in Japan, went to China and brought back Rinzai Zen. So I think we could technically say Eisai really founded Zen, but it was Rinzai Zen. And then, you know, within 50 years, then Dogen founded Soto Zen in Japan. But there's this, you know, if you're into the details of this kind of stuff, there's this great article by William Botiford called Bodhidharma's Precepts in Japan that talks about this whole movement and just his words are, I think, really eloquently express this. He says, on the other hand, while precepts declined in status as codes governing moral behavior in Japan, their importance as an abstract concept grew to an almost absolute degree. Japanese Buddhists began to distinguish between conventional wording of the precepts, to which they assigned secondary importance, and the spiritual essence or ideal precepts, which became equated with Buddhahood itself. Over time, the ordination ceremony, during which a person receives the precepts, came to represent one of the most prominent ritual confirmations of final and complete salvation. So, the precepts, and, you know, I've talked about this even just in Kigen's Jukai, because I think this is a part, now we're in America, we've gone back the other way, I think, and we're really into the conventional version of, well, this is about how we live in the world, and this kind of ultimate confirmation of Buddhahood as Bodhidharma's one mind precepts. Most people have never heard of that, I think, in American Zen. So I think it's nice to include both. Equally balanced and fully both. Neither one at the expense of another. William Botiford says, each precept of the ultimate Buddha expresses the same unified, all-embracing ultimate reality that is Buddha nature. And thus the goal of the ordination ceremony for lay people and priests is the proper ritual confirmation of this Buddha nature, cementing the bond that unites the limited individual person to the universal absolute Buddha. Recast in these terms, this precept embodies awakening realized in one's own present body, in one's own present social circumstances. And this ambiguous symbolism of, is it a literal or ultimate precept, played a major role in the social development of Japanese Zen, especially within the Soto Zen lineage. So, and I think this is maybe new to us in American Soto Zen, that it was really like these precepts were these pointers to Buddha nature, as well as conventional precepts. And that's the real beauty of them. I think if we include both, that hopefully they're never contradictory. Like this killing example is a good one, right? If we really realize that there is no birth and death, we're actually truly embodying that view, then it takes care of the literal. I would propose, and as Rupert Spira confirmed, that we cannot literally kill another being if we're in that perspective of non-separation. So it's, and Zen generally tends to like, let's realize the ultimate and then we will, the conventional will work just great. And as opposed to maybe the earlier Buddhist teachings is let's first be really established in the ethical precepts of the conventional in order to then open to the ultimate. It's kind of a reversal in Zen, classical Zen. That's Bodhidharma's precepts and then Soto Zen. And then we have this, like on the Kechimyaku, the lineage paper that you get at Jukai ceremony, right? You have the blood vein, the blood lineage papers. It has the bloodline running through the ancestors. There's this precept lineage, Bodhisattva precept lineage, which started with Tendai, actually. And they were really into the lineage thing, too. And then included Bodhidharma, but then it went into Tendai ancestors. So there's a lot of stuff, like in this article, that talks about that. But precepts, lineages of awakening became like this kind of big thing in Japan. But at the bottom of our blood lineage, it has this whole paragraph. If you've ever opened up those, when those you have it, you can read this on the bottom of yours. And it says, from the preceptor, like, my teacher revealed to me that that Buddha's precepts or these Bodhisattva precepts are the one great matter's causal condition for our Zen lineage gate. Passed from Shakyamuni Buddha at Vulture Peak through Shaolin, Bodhidharma at Shaolin and the sixth ancestor. So it's a Bodhisattva precepts lineage of the one mind precepts. And the precepts are the one great matter's causal condition, which is this line from the Lotus Sutra about the one great matter of awakening. So that's all some historical background that you could say has nothing to do much with how we actually practice in the world. But it, in fact, I think it's good to know that this history. And now the sutra itself, if we have a little time here. Yes.
Maybe this doesn't happen in any spiritual tradition, but it's kind of interesting that they haven't been contested or rewritten or constitutional amendments.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. And Buddhism, like many religions, like you say, is any religious institution has a built-in conservatism to it, although all these schools develop and evolve. And one example of that is that these so-called Hinayana, or, you know, original, foundational monastic precepts, that tradition is so conservative, right, that that's this whole argument and debate about women's ordination that you probably have all heard about, right, is that... Well, this is nice because this is Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva thing is so flexible. It's like it has its own all-inclusivity built into it. And it's the same for men and women, right? And but those other ones are different for men and women, and they say this Bhikshuni lineage died out in India. In the Theravada tradition, at least in Thailand, right? It died out. And then so therefore it can never be revived because it can only be revived by Shakyamuni Buddha, and he's gone. No, and then of course the less conservative people will say that's crazy, because in China the Bhikshuni lineage of course kept going, right? It kept going mainly in China, which then spread into Korea and Vietnam. So China, Korea, Vietnam have full-fledged Bhikshunis from the time of Shakyamuni Buddha, unbroken. We know that, otherwise it couldn't have happened. Which is beautiful in itself, that there have been people to pass this on. Right? But the Theravada lineages, it died out. So now, as you may know this story, that the Theravada women, who still can do novice nun ordination, but they can't do the full thing. But now they go to China, right? And they get the Chinese Bhikshuni, and they say, well, it's a different precept lineage, but it's close enough. And I think it's close enough. But of course, the super orthodox Thai people will say, no, it's different. It's the Dharmagupta lineage instead of the Theravada lineage. So there's all these debates about this because of religious conservatism. But the Bodhisattva precepts is nice because in a way they don't need to change. I think we could say this third precept this ambiguity about the Chinese character for sexuality leaves is nicely ambiguous because and they're supposed to be for lay people and monastics too, and in America you could say the way we translate these is in a way is a kind of what did you say, like amending or changing them. What was the word? Amendment?
Amendment.
Yeah. In a way, I think the main one of these bodhisattvas, we have different translations that we all use, right? I think the main precept that we've changed in America is the fifth one. When we get to it, we can talk about more. Literally, it's no selling alcohol. You know, the Chinese character for sake. And we've changed it to include and Theravada did this too. Theravada in the Pali and the Sanskrit, it also says alcohol. And then we've changed it to say intoxicants because there's more of them nowadays that have big effect. And we've changed it from, so selling, right, to, there's a minor, of the 48 minor precepts, there's a minor precept called not drinking alcohol. And I think this is the bodhisattva spirit. Is the main thing is we don't want to harm others, so don't sell it to others. Don't be a dealer, right? And
so you can't have a liquor store.
Yeah, and in China, I think it is actually understood that way that you really couldn't actually run a liquor store with the bodhisattva precepts in because they're more literal in China, but. But we say, since we don't have the minor precepts, we're like, we bring in the minor, which is also part of those five lay precepts, right? And we combine them and say, not intoxicating self or others. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, which is quite different from the original. And it's nice, I think, that we include the minor precepts in there too, of oneself.
Mm-hmm. When was the first recorded a schism or at least branching? I mean, with Muhammad, it was with his son, right? It was immediate. But was there one trunk that continued for a while before they started?
Well, there were so many, and I think generally they're not called schisms unless there's like a big kind of controversy and argument about it. It's more like branches where they actually harmoniously say, well, we just have this take on it and you have that take on it, so we're going to develop our own understanding and harmoniously though. So then I think it's a beautiful thing in a way, the branching. And I think right from after the Buddha is in India, or within a century or so after the Buddha, there started becoming these different Indian Buddhist schools, like the Mahasanghikas and the Theravada, Ashtavyaravada, and over slightly different interpretations of both precepts and sutras. And so in India, at the end in India, there were these 18 different subdivisions of Buddhism. And then, of course, in China, then it branches out more. Then you have the Mahayana Sutras, so you have the Flower Ornament School and the Lotus Sutra School and the Zen School and the Pure Land School. So these are all branches. And then Japan adds some more in there. And then America, we really have the full range because we have every country's multiple schools all in one country.
Of all the religions.
Of all the religions and all of Buddhism, yeah. So.
I'm sure there's efforts to reckon, to at least certain reconciling. Is that a viable thing?
Well, I think the main thing is like staying true to the Buddha's basic teachings. So all of these, like, there might be 1,000 Buddhist schools in the world now, if you count all the different countries, they all agree on certain things, like taking refuge in the three treasures. They all have like at least these five basic precepts. I think they all agree on the Pali canon. Even the Mahayana schools say we all agree on that, but the Theravadas don't agree about the Mahayana sutras. They're like, that's not really the sutra. So certain foundational things they all agree on, but it's not so much like we need to come back together. I think it's, some people say, well, maybe there will be an American Buddhism where all these will come together. I don't think so. I think they're too different. And it's beautiful that they're different to me. I think beautiful we have all these different variations to choose from, just like Christianity has all these different sects, and they hopefully harmoniously get along. Sometimes they get along. So the Brahma Net Sutra, in the Pali Canon, there's another Brahma Jala Sutra that talks about all these false views. So they maybe knew about that, and this is unrelated, except by the title. And it even talks about, here's the origin that put in here of the name. Shakyamuni Buddha contemplated the wonderful jewel net hung in Lord Brahma's palace and taught the Brahma Net Sutra for the great assembly. So sometimes Brahma and Indra are equated as these gods, so you may have heard this Indra's net, Indra's jewel net, where all the jewels reflect each other. It may be a reference to the same inconceivable net of interdependence. But Shakyamuni Buddha said, the innumerable worlds in the cosmos are like the eyes of the net, which I guess means like the holes in the net. Each and every world is different. It's a variety infinite. So too are the Dharma gates taught by the Buddhas. So the image of the net is just like the interdependence of everything. And all the differences, just like we're talking about with these different schools of Buddhism, they're all different, but they're actually all one net, one vast net. The radiant Vajra, which means diamond, Vajra jewel precepts. So still, even in our, I think in our Soto Zen ordination, I think it still uses that term, the Vajra jewel precepts. And at the end of the, we may be translated differently, but that part where we talk about the bodhisattvas dancing in all these worlds at the end, I think it uses that term from the sutra here. The radiant Vajra jewel precepts are the original source of all Buddhas and all bodhisattvas, the seed of Buddha nature. So you can see, this is a really Mahayana way of talking about precepts, right? They're the source of all the Buddhas. They are the ultimate Buddha nature. All living beings without exception have Buddha nature. All with consciousness, form, and mind are encompassed by these Buddha nature precepts. Because of these ever-present causes in the form of the precepts, there is without fail always an abiding Dharma body, Dharmakaya. For this reason, the 10 Pratimoksha precepts, which is this old Vinaya term that means conducive to liberation, Pratimoksha precepts came into being in this world. These precepts belong to the true Dharma. They're received and upheld in utmost reverence by all living beings of the three times, past, present, and future. Once again, I shall teach for the great assembly the chapter on the inexhaustible precept treasury. These are the precepts of all living beings whose original self nature is pure. And then these verses that goes into this other Buddha, Vairochana. Now I am Vairochana Buddha, seated on a 1,000-petaled lotus throne. Upon each petal sits a Shakyamuni Buddha. And I know Patrick knows this esoteric line from some of our secret ceremonies. Oh, yes. We recite, that's where these lines come from, is the Brahma Jala Sutra. And Vai, I put in parentheses, because there's this complex discussion that I won't bore you with about, except the fact that it's interesting that in Chinese it says Rochana, the transliteration of Rochana, or Lochana Buddha, right? Which is part of Vai Rochana. So is it just short for Vai Rochana, or is it this other Buddha, Rochana, and in our meal chant, right? Our 10 names of Buddha, we say the pure Dharmakaya, Vairochana Buddha, the complete Sambhogakaya, Lochana Buddha, and the myriad Nirmanakaya, Shakyamuni Buddha. I think that that part is part of this dynamism from this sutra, because Saicho, Saicho. S-A-I-C-H-O is the founder of the Tendai school in Japan. And where do I have that? He says, maybe I didn't bring it, that the Dharma, just like our meal chant, the Dharmakaya is Vairochana Buddha, who's basically the teacher of the flower ornament, Avatamsaka Sutra. Rochana is the Sambhogakaya, who's the teacher of the Brahmajala Sutra. And Shakyamuni Buddha is the Nirmanakaya teacher of, main character in the Lotus Sutra. So he singles out the flower ornament, the lotus, and this Brahmanet Sutra as these three important sutras connected with these three Buddha bodies. So that gets kind of complex, but I think it's an interesting connection here to this, again, related to this sutra. On each petal of this 1,000-petal lotus throne, each petal supports 100 million worlds, and in each world is a Shakyamuni Buddha appearing. So that, in other words, it's this inconceivable Sambhogakaya, you know, only visible to great bodhisattvas, this like pure land in the form of a lotus flower, but on it appears like a Shakyamuni Buddha who's, we can see in every world system. It's part of this Mahayana.
It's very Mahayana.
Very Mahayana, very fast. So there's many world systems. Each, like ours, they each have Shakyamuni Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree. It's kind of like quantum physics theory. It's like there's these multiple universes that are all identical. And they all come from the source of this Dharma. In this case, I think the commentaries sometimes say the Sambhogakaya Rochana or Vairochana is this lotus throne. And these countless Shakyamuni Buddhas all offer flowers, numerous as dust motes, and they all come to my lotus throne, Vairochana. And they listen to the Buddha's precepts from the, in other words, the Dharmakaya is like the ultimate, right? Totally formless. But the Shakyamuni Buddha comes to the ultimate, right? Comes to the ultimate Dharmakaya and receives these Bodhisattva precepts from the Dharmakaya, right? And then I teach the Dharma, opening the gate of sweet dew, which is, you know, we have that chant. It's really like the ambrosia or nectar of the Dharma. And then the countless Buddhas return to their own worlds. So they get the precepts from the Dharmakaya. They return to their own earth world. And then under a Bodhi tree, they proclaim these major and minor precepts of Vairochana, the original Buddha. So it's a little bit like, that's where these precepts came from. It's like the ultimate. And then they come back and they teach it in human language. And they teach it, actually, they say these precepts were taught at the site of the Buddha's enlightenment, right after his enlightenment. It was like the main thing is, wow, the Bodhisattva precepts come out his mouth. And they're like the radiant sun and moon, like a shining jewel necklace. And so on. You can read the rest. I'll skip down some. If you have this trust in these precepts and the precepts are fulfilled, all beings who have mind should accept and uphold them. And then this line, when living beings receive Buddha's precepts, they enter the rank of all Buddhas, the same rank as great awakening. Truly, these disciples are children of all the Buddhas. So that's in our ceremony, yeah. It's a great celebration just after they receive the precepts. So that those lines in our Zen ceremony were drawn from this sutra. Therefore, listen to these. And then it goes back to these bodhisattva precepts are devotion. It really literally says filial piety or filial respect is the Chinese character. But that is not a concept in our culture that I think sits so well. And it's our year of devotion. So I thought devotion worked kind of well for that term. And then also because in the commentaries, they say, we have this one beautiful, if you want, I can send you this PDF of a classic Korean commentary on the sutra, a Zen one, where he says, this filial piety or devotion doesn't just mean like honoring your father and mother. It means, your father and mother gave you your physical body, so you do practice these precepts for them. But your teachers and the Sangha gave you your Dharma body, so you have this devotion towards them too. So it's not literally just parental. Yeah, it covers both. And that's why I think devotion to, and it also in that commentary says, all beings have been our fathers and mothers. So I think in this way, the precepts are the way to be devoted to all beings. Right? I think is the bigger meaning. So he taught the bodhisattva precepts, our devotion to fathers, mothers, the Sangha, and the three treasures. This devotion is the principle of the ultimate path. So the Buddha then emitted limitless light from his mouth, and the whole great assembly consisting of innumerable bodhisattvas and so on joined their palms and listened to these precepts. The Buddha said, twice a month on the new and the full moon, which we still do on the full moon, the tradition is the full and the new moon, I recite these precepts observed by all Buddhas. All bodhisattvas, from those who have just developed bodhicitta to the bodhisattvas in all these stages, also recite them. Therefore, this precept light shines forth from my mouth so that those with affinity are not without a cause, we might say, for awakening. This light, this precept light, is neither blue, yellow, red, white, or black, neither form nor mind, neither existent nor non-existent, neither cause nor effect. So this is again a Mahayana description of the precept light that comes forth from the Buddha's mouth. Like in these words of the precepts, like there is no killing, you know, is like completely beyond our conceptual grasp, I think is what's being pointed to. This precept light is not yellow or red or blue, right? It's colorless, formless. It's radiant, but ungraspable. Right? It's light. These precepts actually are light. This precept light is precisely the original source of all Buddhas, all Bodhisattvas, all disciples of Buddha and the Great Assembly. Therefore, all disciples of Buddha should receive, observe, read, recite, and study these precepts with utmost attention. And then we get into the precepts. But that's all the background, from the earliest kind of guidelines for ethical conduct to like these precepts are actually just like inconceivable light, Buddha nature precepts. And
is there actually more here?
Yeah, there's some more in the text, you know. There's before and after. So these were like, I thought the highlights that really capture the flavor of it. So.
It's as if this light was the expression of harmony, ultimate truth of the source. When it gets translated through the prism of this body, this dreamlike body, breaks up into the way we have to be harmonious is watching our killing, watching our lying, watching our thieving ways.
Yeah, it's really like a, you could say that it's really, the whole sutra is expressing this unity of the two truths of the ultimate and conventional, completely inseparable, which is nice because usually we think of precepts as just very conventional. What's the ultimate part of the precepts? So this sutra brings it out, and I think that's why it became like the Zen precepts, because it's like it's got this Zen flavor of the ultimate woven in, as well as being very practical. So for those who are expecting, we're going to get into like how we practice with these precepts next week, and from all the weeks on, we can start going through the precepts. This is the story of their source.
Two precepts a week.
Yeah, maybe we combine them a little differently. Like the speech ones, we could combine. Yeah, yeah, well, we can see.
Interesting how this is long, but how, you know, as soon as you start practicing the sangha, whether or not you're immediately aware of these, I think you feel them as the body of the sangha life.
Yeah.
But kind of Zen as it's kind of cognized in the larger society. People always ask about enlightenment, or the jokes are like,
yeah,
oh, did you get enlightened? Or something?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They don't ask about the precepts, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's beautiful too, as you mentioned, that we, even if we've never heard of them, we hopefully demonstrated in Sangha life just by practicing together. That's the beauty of practicing together, that we have to talk with each other so that we have these ways of trying to speak harmoniously and not hurting each other and so on. And yeah, again, just being at this Science and Non-Duality conference, I really felt it's a different world, because it wasn't Sangha. There were people there who said, this is my one spiritual thing I do every year, is come to this weekend event.
Yeah.
Like, and there's not even talk about how we live in the world. A little bit there was. But without actually living in Sangha and having practice that we do together, it's hard to, you know, absorb these precepts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So, thanks. Love it. We dedicate the merit of our gathering to the precept light of Vairochana Buddha. May it radiate throughout all world systems. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.